From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
We condemn the Russian Federation's act of aggression.
That was Secretary of State John Kerry speaking this morning on the Ukraine crisis. And coming up on Forum this morning, we'll get two views on the situation in Ukraine. First, former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, will join us on the program. He left that post just last month to return to Stanford University, where he teaches political science. Then we talk about the Obama administration's handling of Ukraine and other recent news and political developments with NPR and ABC political analyst Cokie Roberts. She'll join us in the studio. That's all after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke today for the first time on the Ukraine crisis, defending Russia's actions, but saying that his country would use force in the Ukraine only as a last resort. Also this morning, Secretary of State John Kerry weighed in, speaking bluntly, condemning what he calls Russia's act of aggression. Quote, the Russian government has chosen intimidation and aggression as a first resort. And here's what President Obama had to say.
There is the ability for Ukraine to be a friend of the West's and a friend of Russia's, as long as none of us are inside of Ukraine trying to meddle and intervene, certainly not militarily, with decisions that properly belong to the Ukrainian people.
In this opening half-hour segment of Forum, we talk about the crisis in Ukraine with former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, who stepped down from the post just last month and returned to his position as political science professor at Stanford University. Michael Fall, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin by getting your sense of really right up to the present moment how things stand. Earlier today, Secretary of State Kerry said, we stand with the Ukrainian people, and threatened actually to isolate Russia diplomatically and economically. And the fact is, at this point, the Russians look at this very differently and through an entirely different lens. They're saying this has all been to some extent orchestrated by the West, and they're protecting ethnic Russians. So we seem to be pretty much at loggerheads?
We're most certainly at loggerheads. It's a very dangerous moment because we could be at loggerheads now, but it could get a lot worse if, goodness, you know, God forbid, you have shooting in Crimea or you have violence in the east of Ukraine. But I think the moment now has to be for diplomacy. I think it's right that Secretary Kerry went to Kiev and will be traveling on to Moscow with a message of de-escalation, with a message that you cannot invade other countries, then that we have to let the Ukrainian people decide their own fate. And in the press conference today that President Putin did, I watched it, there were some very aggressive things he said, some very threatening things he said, including most disturbingly to me that because there's been a revolution in Kiev, that was the words he used, we no longer have to honor our commitments that we signed with the government, the state of Ukraine, before that revolution. That's very ominous. But he also left the door open for negotiation. He also said, we don't want to annex Crimea. Force is a last resort. And we want to return to the February 21st agreement in terms of a way forward for a political process that would produce a new legitimate government in Ukraine.
And on the other hand, Yanukovych was democratically elected, and the United States position has been that the opposition is really democratic somehow or ought to be supported in the same way, I suppose, that there's support for those who overthrew the democratically elected government of Egypt.
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than that. First of all, he was the democratically elected leader of Ukraine, and we engaged him accordingly. Vice President Biden, I think, called him over a dozen times as president. We were not ignoring him. We were not saying he was illegitimate. But then he made a big decision. He chose to murder his own citizens on the streets of Kiev. That was a major act that he did that brought, in the eyes of many Ukrainians, illegitimacy to him. And yet, even after that had happened, he did sit down with the opposition and agreed to a path forward on February 21st. And then for reasons I have to tell you honestly, I quite frankly do not understand to this day, he fled the country. He didn't stay to work with that agreement. He didn't stay to plan for the elections that they had put forth. And so the opposition, and I want to make clear here, the elected members of the Ukrainian parliament voted in an interim government, including, by the way, two dozen, maybe even three dozen, if I remember right, members of Yanukovych's own party voted for the interim government that you have today. So it most certainly was not a perfect democratic process. But given the chaoticness of the moment, I think that vote in the Rada needs to be recognized. It was a very large majority vote of many different parties, not just the so-called opposition. Why Yanukovych chose to flee, I mean, I saw his press conference. I watched it from Sochi, in fact, when he was in Rostov. He gave a very confusing explanation, which to this day I don't understand why he did leave.
Talking with former ambassador of Russia, Michael McFaul, professor of political science at Stanford. And what about your sense of who the opposition is made up of? I mean, you mentioned the opposition that has been involved in essentially an accord that was reached. But there's been a lot of concern about, well, neo-Nazis and particularly the far right, Dmitriy Yarosh specifically, but Nazi sympathizers that in some ways Putin has intimated may have driven Yanukovych out to leave. That is, he was fearful of them and fearful of his own safety.
Well, you're quite right to say that there are radical elements in Ukraine that will have threatened and have at times used illegitimate means to pursue their political ends. And there should be, in my opinion, no excuse for that. They should be isolated. They should go before a court of law, just like anybody else that uses those means. I do think it's been grossly exaggerated the role that this particular, you know, fringe elements are playing in Ukrainian politics. You know, the prime minister, Mr. Yatsenyuk, has been a member of parliament for many, many years, worked with Yanukovych and Yushchenko, and he's a member of the establishment, I guess I would say. Mr. Turchinov, the acting president, same thing. He's a prominent member of one of the major political parties that have been in the Rada for many, many years. So I take the point that the radicals need to be given the same scrutiny when they use force as the government is. But I think it's inaccurate to say that the Nazis are taking over Ukraine. And particularly in Crimea, I would just point out to your listeners, there's not been one instance of violence, not one. So if you watch the Russian media, as I do, and used to every day, but still do from here, you would have thought that Crimea had been invaded by Nazis and bandits and terrorists. And yet the reporters down there, they're looking for those people. There hasn't been one instance of violence in Crimea. So the excuse that President Putin has rolled out for why those soldiers need to be in Crimea, there's just really no justification for it.
As long as we're, for the at least moment, talking about Nazis, there's also been from the other side a lot of criticism about the Russians going into Crimea because it's sovereign. And the comparisons have been made to the Sudetenland. And I wonder if I could get your perspective not only of that, but also the historical perspective vis-a-vis Georgia. A lot of certainly recriminations against Russia that have been linked to just the behavior that Russia showed back then with Georgia and that they're showing again now in Crimea.
Yes, I think, if I had it in front of me, I would read to you President Putin's op-ed piece in the New York Times a few months ago, where he spelled out that in order to have international order, we have to use the UN Security Council to have consensus. And the phrase I think he had, the law is a law, whether you like it or not, about sovereignty. And I think he's right about that. And I think, to let that break down and to let countries begin to just annex and occupy on a whim in the name of protecting, ethnic Russians or their brethren here or there, that would, the international system would break down. And that's why I think the president, President Obama, and the rest of the international community, not just the West, by the way, the entire international community needs to stand for those principles and not allow this to stand as a de facto annexation or some ambiguous sovereignty that might come about in Crimea.
Our guest is political scientist Michael McFaul of Stanford University, recently returned from Moscow following 2 years of diplomatic service as U.S. ambassador to Russia. And we welcome your calls. This is a half-hour segment. Cokie Roberts will be joining us at 9:30. So if you have something you'd like to bring to the table here in terms of our conversation about what's going on in Ukraine, or if you have questions for Michael McFaul, feel free to join us now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. Again, join us, toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. What about Putin's blaming the West? And I want to get particularly, if I can, your perspective, because you were kind of cast as part of the Western opposition plotting against Mother Russia or Father Putin when you were ambassador, vilified as sent by Washington to sow chaos. A lot of this can be seen.
Yeah.
A lot of this can be seen, obviously, as part of a new Russian nationalism, and people are saying we need to reset the reset, and Russia is moving us toward the Cold War. But I've read statements that you've made which are much more optimistic and sanguine.
Well, you know, in my view, a real Russian nationalist wants Russia to be democratic, prosperous, and respected in the world. I have lots of friends in Russia, in the government and out of the government, that consider themselves to be patriotic. I like that word better than nationalist. And they would say that. That's what we want. And I see nothing wrong with that. I think that's good. I think a stable, democratic, a prosperous Russia could be a very important partner for the United States and the rest of Europe. And that's why this event, to me, is such a tragedy, because it sets back Russia. It creates forces to isolate Russia once again. It brings back all the worst memories of the Soviet Union and the Russian Empire. And that's why, you know, I think it is a very costly mistake that President Putin has embarked upon. And I hope it doesn't get more costly. I hope more rational thinking, including in his own thinking, by the way. I mean, Putin is of two minds of what he wants to do next. That was apparent to me in the press conference. And so I hope they think about that longer term strategy about what it would mean to make Russia a great power again. It's not invading your neighbors. That will not make Russia great. On the contrary, it'll have deleterious consequences, including economic consequences for Russia.
I like your framing it as what you hope would be patriotic rather than nationalistic, but it certainly has a lot of the earmarks of nationalism, especially with what's going on.
Yes.
In terms of human rights abuses and with Pussy Riot, which has gotten a great deal of attention, the expulsion of U.S. international development advisors. I mean, this is in some ways not, and the crackdown in many people's minds, significantly indicative of a kind of neo-Cold War. But let me just ask you something else, because I want to get to our emailers and callers, and we only have a limited time with you. And that is, clearly, Ukraine is in some serious economic, they're really almost in a default position, and Putin offered them billions of dollars. If they would go over to the EU, they wouldn't necessarily get that kind of money. They would have to go through an austerity program that's pretty much been delegated by the IMF that would be in the cards for them. I mean, in terms of just trade and money, in terms of basic economics, how much of this conflict that we're seeing now in Crimea has to do with that?
Well, I think the first order issue, the immediate issue, is to resolve the political crisis and to get the Russians out of Crimea. I think there will be a time and a place to talk about EU accession versus trading with Russia and joining their Eurasian Union. Our position as a government before I left, and you just heard President Obama articulate it again, was there's no reason that we should force Ukraine to choose, right? They can have good trading relations with their partners in the East and West. Think of the analogy for a minute. We have a deep trading relationship with Canada. Got deeper because of NAFTA. Now I know my Canadian colleagues in Moscow are talking about, you know, expanding trade and reducing trade barriers with Russia. That's great. Why would we want to, you know, get in the way of that? Why would we say, oh, no, you can't do that because you have to only trade with America? That's not the way the 21st century works. And so I hope that, you know, once we can that hopefully this crisis will resolve and we can get back to thinking in those terms for Ukraine, because a prosperous Ukraine, after all, is good for Russia. Those are consumers that will buy Russian goods. That creates investments for Russian investors. To me, this can be a win-win situation for Russia, Ukraine, and the rest of Europe.
Let's bring in our callers. Frank, you're first up here. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. First, I'd like to congratulate Ambassador McFaul for doing a very, very good job in a very difficult tour. You served us well, sir.
Thank you.
I'd also like you to draw on that experience and give us your analysis of Putin's view of why he thought he could get away with this, and in particular, whether you thought he had any reaction to Obama's recent series of responses to Russian overtures that might have encouraged him.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's important to understand that, at least from my point of view, I want to be careful. I don't want to read into things I don't know. But I have worked with President Putin and Prime Minister Putin. I've witnessed him. I spent 3 years at the White House before going to Moscow. And, you know, the vision that he has is to create this Eurasian Economic Union that I mentioned before. And pivotal to that was to have Ukraine be a part of that. That's his big foreign policy goal. I would say it's his most important foreign policy goal that he's focused on right now. If you go back several months, he, in his view, achieved a major victory when President Yanukovych refused to sign this accession agreement with the European Union. And for Russian officials, I was working in Moscow at the time, that was seen as a great achievement. That's why they were extremely frustrated with President Yanukovych when he failed, in their view, to restore order, when he failed, in their view, to bring about stability in the subsequent responses that you had on the streets, and then ultimately fled. And so the response to the losing that battle, if you will, right, losing the battle for Ukraine with the collapse of President Yanukovych and his government, that's the response. The tactical response is to go into Crimea. I don't think Putin's decided where he wants to go from there, because he really wanted all of Ukraine to be part of his Eurasia Economic Union. Most certainly occupying Crimea is not going to make that happen. On the contrary, it's going to make it for certain that Ukraine will not be part of that vision. So I think he has not quite decided what his next move here is. And I would describe the move as a tactical, impulsive response to what happened to his partner, President Yanukovych, and not some grand strategy that he's been thinking about for decades about how do I go in and annex the Crimea.
Well, let me thank Frank for his call. It ought to probably be pointed out that Russia and Ukraine share a border. Russia is the biggest trading partner and the source of much of Ukraine's energy.
Yes.
And, so this ongoing relationship is particularly important if there's going to be respect for the sovereignty of Ukraine. However, there are those who see these machinations as being somehow tied to a desire to recreate the former Soviet Union. And I'm just wondering, if you have any light perhaps you could shed on that 90-minute phone call that took place between President Obama and Putin, do you think promises were made, or was there any clarity that was focused on? Do we know what went on for an hour and a half of conversation?
I don't think there was clarity. I think there was a statement of positions. And I think both leaders, obviously I wasn't part of the call, although I've been part of many of those calls before. But I have, I have a sense of what happened. And I think there was statement of principles and statement of animosity. But I would hope that there was also some discussion about what are the off-ramps to this crisis, right? How do we de-escalate this crisis so that it doesn't go further? And the reason that's so important is exactly because of what you just mentioned, Michael, that Ukraine is a giant country, almost 50 million people. Millions of Russians are in the east, that's right, but that they tend to live in the cities in the east and are surrounded by Ukrainians that live in the rural areas. So it's not just like, okay, we're going to take this piece that they're Russians. It would be a very messy process if President Putin tried to do that. And so far, you know, the government in Kiev has showed a lot of restraint. But I am nervous that if you saw more military activity, particularly in the east, that restraint might give way to those that want to do battle. And that would be just a horrible tragedy for Ukraine and for all of Europe to have a civil war in the heart of Europe.
What's the possibility of that? I mean, as you see things,
I can't predict. I don't know, but I am worried about it. And I think about other historical analogies in Europe, where things started just a little piece, this, that, or the other, and we thought it was going to stop with that, and then there are a series of unanticipated consequences that happen when you have a lot of people with guns staring at each other. And that worries me. That worries me that this could spiral out of control. I think we should all be very concerned about that.
Let me bring another caller. Mark, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was speaking to a few friends of mine and kind of trying to make sense of all this. And do you think that perhaps it's just a, you know, like you said, a return to glory or even a land grab for a warm water port? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for the question. Russia wants a warm water port, Michael McFaul?
Well, they have the port already. That's the paradox of this is that they're there already. They have, I think, a 50-year lease with that naval base. So that's there. But the caller raised a different piece as well, which is that there is a nostalgia for Crimea in Russia. I mean, I'm on Twitter, often. Find me, at McFaul, if you want to join the conversation in Russian and English. And you'll see there in conversation with my Russian interlocutors, you know, all kinds of arguments. You know, Khrushchev gave this away. This is part of Russia. You know, we rightly conquered Crimea back during Catherine the Great's period. How could he have given this away? And that sentiment is in a part of Russian society and is in a part of society in Crimea. And that is true. But I would also say it's not necessarily everybody agrees with that. And I think people need to understand that even the population in Crimea is only 60% Russian. The rest are Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars that don't want to be part of Russia. And inside Russia, if you look at opinion polls, there's a lot of disagreement about whether people think it's wise to get involved in the internal affairs of Ukraine.
We've only got seconds left, but there's a tweet here about whether these ongoing events in Ukraine will affect the administration's non-proliferation agenda. Yes or no?
Could possibly. If things go sour, all different parts of our relationship could unravel.
Michael McFaul, so good to have you with us and good to have you back. Thank you.
All right, let's do it again sometime.
Spasiba, do svidaniya, and when we return, Cokie Roberts.